Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy. Committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
Support for WPR comes from Tomorrow River Community Virtual School, delivering Waldorf-inspired live virtual lessons to grades 4K through 8th, open to all Wisconsin students. More is at trcvs.org.
After 7 minutes of terror, early on Monday morning Central Time, the Mars rover Curiosity landed safely in the Gale Crater beside a Martian mountain.
Descending at about 0.75 meters per second as expected. Expecting bridle cut shortly.
Rim is stable.
UHF is good. Touchdown confirmed. We're safe on Mars.
Kind of gives you goosebumps, doesn't it? We are safe on Mars. We will talk with one of the scientists who was celebrating what some NASA officials are calling the Super Bowl of planetary exploration. And being from UW Green Bay, she knows her Super Bowls. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Wednesday, August 8th. We will discuss the Curiosity mission to Mars this hour, and we'll welcome your questions, your reactions, your hopes or concerns at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. What is the purpose of the Curiosity mission? What do we hope to learn? Is this really necessary? How awesome are the photos and images that are already coming back? Our guest is Eileen Yangst, adjunct assistant professor and director of the Wisconsin Space Grant Consortium at UW Green Bay. She's at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California right now. She is the deputy principal investigator for one of the cameras on the mission, and she joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for joining us early West Coast time. We appreciate it. Boy, did that sound exciting. Were you on the edge of your seat?
I was not even sitting down at that point. I was standing with most of the other scientists. It was just as exciting and nerve-wracking as it sounds on the recording that you played.
Yeah, so tell us what that was like. Did you go through 7 or 14 minutes of terror?
Yes, absolutely. We all did. We find that we kind of, there's such a thing as anthropomorphization, and we sort of become technomorphized. We become the rover. And we were all kind of on the edge of our seats because we felt like we were going down through the 7 minutes of terror with the rover. And it was exhilarating and exciting and awe-inspiring and humbling all at the same time when we finally did land safely. This is absolutely one of the hardest things that we've ever done, and it was flawless. It was beautiful.
Tell us, give us a scope of how hard this was.
This is very comparable on the unmanned side to the Apollo missions. This is as complex, as technically difficult, as any unmanned mission that NASA has ever put together. The number of new types of technology, the number of new things we were trying to be able to get a rover this large, this heavy, this complex down on the surface, the only thing you can really compare it to is the Apollo missions.
Yeah. And it's there, and it's already sending pictures back. This is just amazing.
You know, it was amazing to us, too, and we all expected that first picture to come down relatively quickly, and then within 5 minutes, there it was. There was the surface. And you realize that no human being in history, in the history of the human race, has ever seen that scene before. And we got to see it together, not just with our colleagues, not just with the engineers at JPL, but with the world. And that has never been possible before. This is absolutely unique in human history.
Why is it important for us to see that first photo all together as a world?
Because we are one world. There really isn't a better answer than that. We all contributed to this mission, especially here in this country. We are a democracy, and we pay our taxes, and those taxes go to certain things. And one of the things it goes to is space exploration, this reaching out into the next frontier. And of course, we should all experience that together. It's not just for an elite few. It's for all of us.
What is the purpose, the mission of Curiosity?
The science goal of Curiosity is to examine one area of Mars in terms of habitability. Was this an area that where life could have either arisen or have survived for a period of time long enough to have left evidence that it was there?
And why do we want to know that?
I think it's one of the most profound questions that you can ask. Are we alone? And to discover, if we should discover, that this was once a habitable zone, that this was a place where life could have arisen, we find on Earth that life is extremely tenacious. And to discover that life could be could have arisen somewhere else in one single solar system has really profound possibilities for all of the other solar systems that might be out there.
Don't we know already that there is evidence that water was where Curiosity is right now at one time?
We know that Mars was once a lot wetter than it is currently, and we believe, based on the orbital evidence, that that there was significant amount of water for a significant period of time in Gale. It's one of the reasons we're going there. It has this beautiful stack. The mountain that people are talking about in the center of the crater is a stack of sedimentary layers. So anybody who's been to the Grand Canyon and seen the layers, that's essentially the history of the Earth in one area, or at least part of that history. We're hoping that that's what we're seeing in Gale as well, a stack of sediments that will allow us to look backward in time for this part of Mars. So yes, we know that Mars was once wetter. We believe that this was an area, that Gale is an area that was much wetter than it is now. But we'll know better after we've been there for a little bit and we're able to look at these images.
So what is the atmosphere like on Mars?
The atmosphere on Mars is something like 0.007% that of Earth. It is tremendously thin. I've heard one engineer in explaining entry, descent, and landing say that it is just enough to get in our way, but not really enough to help us out all that much, especially with a rover this size. The atmosphere is mostly carbon dioxide, with a couple of trace gases, and again, the pressure is extremely low. We talk about dust storms on Mars, and they have, you know, the winds are very high velocity, but they're not carrying much, right? They're not carrying much power behind them, and so you know, we send rovers there all the time, not worried really that they're going to be knocked over. So the atmosphere is extremely thin. It's not enough anymore to give us enough pressure for water to be on the surface for any length of time.
Pretty darn cold there right now.
Absolutely. A warm, sultry day on Mars doesn't really get above freezing. And it's usually, you know, much colder than that. Hundreds of degrees or 100 degrees below zero is not, you know, unheard of. So
the you are the deputy principal investigator for one camera on the mission. What's your camera doing these days?
My camera is the Mars Hand Lens Imager, or MOLLI for short. And MOLLI is has the highest resolution of any mobile camera that we have ever sent to another planet. So to put that in perspective, what that means is if there was a single grain of talcum powder on Mars, we could pick that out of a MOLLE image. So MOLLE is mounted on the turret, which is that big arm on the rover. There are lots of instruments on the turret. It's actually, some of the engineers call it the cheese head because of kind of how it's shaped, which, of course, I've totally warmed to that idea.
That is, did they do that on purpose because you're from Green Bay?
You know, I wish I could say that was the case.
That's funny.
But I did discover that, and I've embraced it certainly as my own. So MOLLE is on the end of this arm with many other instruments. And what that means is that MOLLE is mobile. She can, if you can raise the arm above the rover so you can take pictures from up above, sort of a periscope type view. You can get the arm underneath. You can take pictures down below, underneath the rover. So it's a lot like putting a camera in your hand instead of in front of your eyes. And if that camera can focus on its own, you can take all sorts of pictures that you wouldn't normally be able to take. And you can take them at this very, very high resolution. So what MOLLE is doing right now, we just did our first checkout. So we just sent back our very first picture of the Martian surface in color. And that was MOLLE's very first image on the surface.
Also, that sort of a red hazy picture was from MOLLE?
That's correct. It is still stowed because we haven't done the arm checkout yet. But MOLLE is able to, it can still see through, right, based on how it is on the turret. It can still take pictures from the stowed position. So if you look at the picture as it is, it's kind of got this cockeyed look to it. And that's because the MOLLE is actually still stowed. But yes, that kind of foggy-looking picture was from MOLLE. Now, of course, it looks like that because it has the dust cover on it, which is a good thing because there was a lot of dust kicked up from the sky crane. And so the dust cover is protecting the optics of that camera right now.
How exciting. This is really great. And what are you doing in Pasadena to monitor or control MOLLE?
Well, at this point, most of the sequences are already planned. They've already been sent to the rover, and that's for safety's sake. So we have a planned sequence that we've already tested out in the test bed, and we know that the sequence works. If everything's working well, we'll be able to diagnose all of the instruments and all of the systems and so on. They're done in a specific order so that nothing is messing up anything else, right? And so those sequences are executing for the next 20 Martian days or 20 sols. My job right now is to analyze the images as they come down with, you know, the rest of the scientists who are here. As we get further on into the mission and the scientists are kind of let loose, we get kind of the keys to the rover after a certain amount of time when we know everything is working. I will be involved in helping plan and execute what the MOLLE camera will be taking pictures of.
We are talking with Eileen Yangst. She's an adjunct assistant professor, director of the Wisconsin Space Grant Consortium at UW-Green Bay. And she is in Pasadena, California right now at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. She is the deputy principal investigator for a camera on the mission. Just heard her talking about MOLLE. MOLLE sent back that red, foggy image of the surface of Mars. We are talking about the Curiosity mission to Mars, and we're welcoming your questions. We're welcoming your action, your reactions to what's going on. Did you watch by any chance on when this was going on early Monday morning? Any questions about the mission on Mars? What do you hope for the future of space exploration, maybe even human space exploration? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up, Ben Marins is with you after 3 this afternoon. On Monday and Tuesday of this week, you heard from the candidates for U.S. Senate, the Republican primary candidates for U.S. Senate. Now, today after 3, Ben and his guest will review all of them, discuss the issues and policies that they're running on, and take a look at the latest poll numbers. He welcomes in Professor Charles Franklin to talk about the U.S. Senate race after 3 o'clock this afternoon. We are talking about curiosity, and we're wondering if you're curious about what's going on Mars. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Or maybe you're someone who is questioning the purpose or the money being spent on this mission. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We are talking with one of the scientists on the mission. She's from UW-Green Bay. She is the principal investigator for a camera on the mission. And our first caller is Janice in La Crosse. Hi, Janice.
Hi, Joy. Good morning. Thank you, and to your guest also. I just personally feel like, you know, yes, it was an amazing accomplishment. It would have been devastating if they would have not been able to do this. And I know they had to have, like, 76 things had to go right, they said. If one went wrong, the whole thing would have been out of it. But my focus is, like, you know, after spending billions of dollars on something like that, and all these engineers, can't we do something a little bit more down here on Earth since we're all bankrupt down here? I mean, it's hard to fathom that, you know. It's kind of hard to justify that type of money, you know, millions of miles away. We can't live there. There's nothing out there. You can take a picture. You can see that much. So, I mean, why do we need to be focusing out on Mars? Let's start focusing on the planet Earth. And maybe even our oceans and the pollution. And you know, there's so many problems. We got things going on down here, people. Let's start focusing on our own Earth. I don't really care about the red planet Mars with nothing out there but dust and freezing weather.
All right. Janice, I want, this is what a lot of people, or I should say a number of people, are wondering. Is it really worth the cost? Couldn't we be using that money better elsewhere? What do you say, Eileen Yanks, to the concern that this just cost a whole bunch of money and wondering whether it's worth it?
Well, I won't gainsay. $2.5 billion is a lot of money, even though it is over, you know, say a decade. But it's important to keep it in perspective. Americans last year spent more on plastic surgery than NASA's entire budget. So, yes, it is a great deal of money, but it is, again, something that we need to keep in perspective. Now, I think it's entirely fair that the taxpayer should ask, what am I getting for that investment? It turns out that NASA has returned something like $7 for every one that the taxpayer has invested, which is a pretty good investment. The difference here is that investment matures, if you will, over 20 to 25 years, which is unfortunately not within an election cycle. So if you are using, say, a cellular phone, or if you are sitting in front of a laptop, or if you are, if you've ever used an MRI or a CAT scan or a fetal heart monitor, these are all things that have come from the investment that my parents made in the space program back in the 60s. We are just now realizing and utilizing that investment. It takes a lot of money to make the first widget. Once it's done, then companies can take that technology and take that knowledge and develop it into something wonderful and great for the economy. But it takes a decent amount of time. I would encourage people to that is the case, that investment is worthwhile. And I would also point out, there's an old joke, and it is when the United States decided that we needed to be able to write, that the astronauts in space needed to be able to write something down, we invested a good deal of money into creating a pen that would write in microgravity. What did the Soviets do? They used pencils. Fair enough. On the other hand, the Soviets, now the Russians, are still essentially using the same technology to get to space as they did in the 60s, whereas we have advanced leaps and bounds over that technology. On the science side, I would say that it is important to see the Earth in context, in the same way that a doctor would never be worth her salt if she only saw one patient. She needs to see many, many patients to understand that one person in context. We need to understand the planet Earth in context. If you've never met a person before, and you see one person, you might say, okay, well, most people may have two eyes, two legs, and so on. But you also might assume that every person has brown hair and brown eyes and is a woman, which, of course, is not the case. That's why context is important. The greenhouse effect was first discovered on Venus, for example. We didn't even know to ask that question until we had seen it on another planet. So I would say both on the science and the technology side, the investment is worth it. We don't always know what it is that we do that will bring about that most obvious jump in technology and science. But we do know that when we invest in science and technology, we get a tremendous return in that investment.
Janice said, you know, I don't really care what a dusty, cold, red, barren planet like Mars looks like. We'll never live there, she said, among other things. Will we ever live there?
That will depend on whether that's something that we want to do. Technologically, yes, I don't see any barriers to living there. And there are many folks who believe that that's, you know, our next step. But it will depend on if that is something that folks want to put their time and effort into. I don't think technologically we are held back.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Eileen Yangst. She is the director of the Wisconsin Space Grant Consortium at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. And she is also the deputy principal investigator of one of the cameras that is on the Curiosity mission on Mars, the Curiosity rover, which landed safely early Monday morning and is already transmitting images and videos back to Earth. We are getting an interesting look at what's going on the surface of Mars in the Gale Crater. And in fact, we did post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page the picture that that our guest sent us. And I believe that's the first picture that her camera, Molly, sent to Earth. Let's take another call from Scott in Milwaukee. Hello, Scott.
Hi there, and thanks for having me on. First thing I just wanted to say quickly is actually just a quick message to everyone in NASA. I actually really wanted to thank you guys. As someone who likes to think and dream big ideas, I think it's awesome that we actually spend money so people can think big thoughts and dream big ideas. But I guess my real question is basically one of politics. It's no real secret that NASA and its future is not exactly on the most stable of grounds, or at least where I would like to see it. And I was wondering how you would say the culture of NASA has maybe changed or has dealt with a sort of uncertain future. Is there added pressure on this mission to perform successfully?
Yes, it is added pressure, I would say. I don't know much about the culture of NASA in general. I can only speak for myself. But what I can say is that as difficult as it is to do science when you don't know what you are going to be allowed to do next month, much less next year, much less within 10 years, although that is difficult, it is important for us as scientists to remember that, again, that money comes from the taxpayers, and we need to show a good return for that money. And if the general consensus is that we're going the wrong direction and people want to focus on other things, then, you know, we have to be sensitive to that. Having said that, and being a science researcher, it's very difficult to change your direction on a 1 to 2 year cycle, which is essentially an election cycle. That tends to mean that we lose momentum and we lose investment because you've gone down a certain path, you've trained people, you've done, you know, the hardware and so on, and then, well, 2 years later, now we're doing something different, and so you have to dismantle what you have done and focus on something else, and you tend to lose personnel that way, you lose institutional knowledge, and that's only in my own experience as a researcher, but it can be very frustrating. So, you know, I'm really of two minds about it. But I am at heart an explorer and at heart an optimist, and I guess that's why I'm still in science.
So how long will Curiosity be on Mars or sending us pictures?
Well, that's a good question, and there's not really an answer for that. The nominal mission is one Martian year, which is two Earth years. Having said that, Opportunity is still rolling. It had a 90 Martian day nominal mission, and it has been going for 8 years. We could last for another few seconds, or we could last for several decades. But it's clearly a well-designed rover. So far, everything checks out, and you know, I'm just focusing on tomorrow at this point.
Yeah, I bet you are. So two? Did you say two Martian years?
One Martian year, which is essentially two Earth years.
Oh, there. Okay, that's I get it. And Curiosity just stays on Mars. It doesn't come back, does it?
That's correct. And I do get this question often from kids who, on some level, are rather distressed when they discover that the rover is not coming back. And so I do want to say to them and to everyone the same thing I tell my children. The rover is home. The rover was designed for Mars. Mars is the rover's home. And so, no, the rover's not coming back here because it's home now.
Our next caller is Tom in Loyal. Hello, Tom.
Good morning, Joe. I wanted to ask your guest, I guess some of the stuff you've talked about has been covered already that I wanted to ask, but I guess I'm looking to the future. I know we have a satellite up there around Mars that's mapping the Martian surface. And I'm wondering, are we looking forward someday within the next 20 years, hopefully, of sending a mission to Mars?
A manned mission to Mars.
Yes, a manned mission.
Mm-hmm. At the moment, the president's vision puts us towards getting a human mission to Mars by 2030. Again, election cycles sometimes change things, sometimes they don't. Right now, 2030 is the goal.
Wow. So
in my lifetime, we're crossing our fingers.
Well, and you don't necessarily follow, perhaps, well, maybe you do, the current budget cycle. Didn't NASA take a big cut in its budget?
Actually, as space grant director, I don't have a choice. I absolutely follow the budget cycle. And again, that can make it very difficult when you are trying to think 10 or 15 years down the line and you don't know what your budget is going to be next month because there's been a delay or there's been a continuing resolution or whatever. Somewhat frustrating, but no different than anybody else who's working under the federal government's budget right now.
Randy in Madison is with us now. Hi, Randy.
Good morning.
Morning.
Great show. I think that the landing on Mars has been a fantastic success for U.S. prestige, and the cost has been so minimal in relative terms. I was reading an article the other day that the landing on Mars cost around $2.5 billion. And that Americans spend $7 billion a year on potato chips. So the cost is quite small compared to the return in prestige and information alone.
Yeah, the prestige is important too, Professor Yingst.
As a scientist, I don't think I'm supposed to talk about that one way or the other. I am very, very proud of this mission, and I'm proud as an American of this mission, because I don't know that it could have been done in this way anywhere else, given all of the problems with budgets and uncertainties and so on. We have, a populace that is anxious to explore and anxious to reach as far as possible and dare great things. And I do think there is prestige in that. I think that's something that we as a country and we as Americans should be proud of. This is certainly an international mission. There are many of my colleagues are from many other countries, and they've put this effort into it as well, and they should be just as proud. But as an American, I feel like this is something that would be hard to do anywhere else, and it was certainly audacious, and we should be proud of that audacity.
So, what's the next awesome thing, Molly? On Cheesehead is going to be sending us.
We have several instrument checkouts that are going to happen in the next couple days, and then one of the prime missions for Molly is to support the other instruments. So as they are used, Molly will be used to document the work that they did. So when the alpha proton X-ray spectrometer is put down, Molly will take before and after pictures to make sure that everything is copacetic, and it will document the work and so on of other instruments. So I think those are some of the next images that we're going to be taking. Again, I'm chomping at the bit to get the keys to the rover so we can drive off and do some serious science.
We'll take more of your calls for Eileen Yangst, who is at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. She is working on the Curiosity mission. And we wonder what you're curious about. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Talking about the purpose of the mission, what the rover might find, the future of humans on Mars. And we're wondering if you think this is awesome or not. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Tomorrow at this time, did you know that self-deception is actually a good thing? I'll talk with a guest who says thinking we're smarter or more good-looking than we actually are can help us win over others and succeed. So self-deception tomorrow from 8 until 9. That ought to be outstanding, if I do say so myself. We are talking about another outstanding thing, the Curiosity mission to Mars, with our guest from UW-Green Bay, who's involved in this mission, Eileen Yangst. And our next caller is Judy in Eagle. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Eileen. Thank you so much. I just wanted to say that my husband and I stayed up and watched it live, and it was just absolutely riveting. And it certainly did remind us of that experience we had watching the moon landing many, many decades ago.
Yeah.
And the thing that I really took away from this is that I think it creates an opportunity for a whole new generation of kids to get really excited about science and learning. And also, we were just struck by how when we really put our minds to working together, how collaboration and imagination can be just so powerful and productive. And, that's what has just got us so excited, and to follow it, we're really looking forward to it. And the other thing I just wanted to comment on, too, if the mission hadn't, succeeded, that failure is also part of taking risk and exploration. And I just think sometimes we think we can't do anything anymore if there's a potential for failure.
Yeah.
And
Wonderful comments,
Judy. Yeah, I just wanted to throw one kudo out to Mohawk guy. He was really awesome.
I was just thinking about him. I was like, what was that Mohawk guy's name? Everybody's proposing to him now, too, via Twitter. They're asking, do you know Mohawk guy, Eileen?
I don't. I'm so sorry I don't. I'd love to be able to bask in that particular glory, but no.
You do agree with Judy that this is got to be great for getting kids interested in science to watch this kind of this unfold before our eyes.
Well, there's no question in my mind. Again, as the Wisconsin Space Grant Director, I do a lot of presentations around the state to K through 12 students as well as higher education students. And it is clear to me every time I talk to them and every time they talk to me that NASA is really in the business of inspiration. And that gets poo-pooed sometimes, and that's unfortunate because it's really inspiration that drives kids to take the hard courses and persevere, which is sometimes even harder, in the hard courses because they have that dream in front of them. Very rarely does a child come up to me and say, you know what, I really want to work for the IOC someday. With all due respect to the IOC, most of the time I want to be an astronaut. I want to build rovers myself. I want to build satellites. I want to take pictures of other planets. That really inspires them, and it not only gets them into science and math, but it keeps them there when it's difficult for them. It was difficult for me. I was not a natural mathematician. I think it's really important for me to mention this publicly, to come clean. For any student who's listening, math was a tremendous struggle for me, especially in college. I stuck with it because there was nothing else I wanted to do but to be a space scientist. And as far as failure goes, you know, I have seen both extremes. My first job as a postdoctoral fellow was working as a scientist on Mars Polar Lander, which was not a successful mission. That one crashed in December 3 of 1999. And so I have seen both sides of this. And I can tell you that the success that we saw with Curiosity in part was because of the failure that we had with Mars Polar Lander. But you must learn from your failures. I tell my kids this all the time. It's not what you're good at. It's what you're willing to work at. It's what you're willing to fail at that will get you places.
Judy, thanks again for the call. John in Winnebago is with us. Hello, John.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask, how do you make sure that you're getting a representative sample of Mars? How do you determine where you want to land the rover? For instance, like if you were landing on Earth, if you landed at the Grand Canyon, it would be a completely different, so you'd get completely different results than if you landed somewhere in Iowa or Wisconsin or
New York City.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, why was the Gale Crater chosen, Professor Yingst?
Let me answer both of those questions because I think there were two. There was, why was Gale Crater chosen, and how do you know you're getting a representative sample? I think both of those are worthwhile, very worthwhile questions to answer. To answer the last one first, we know very well we're not getting a representative sample. So, for example, when people say, oh, we've been to the moon, absolutely we've been to the moon, in the same way that, say, if you've walked the National Mall in Washington, D.C., you can say you've been to Earth. That's factual, but it doesn't actually cover everything.
Mm-hmm.
So the best we can do is to choose an area where we think we are getting the most bang for our buck. So if I was looking at Earth and having never been here before as a geologist, the Grand Canyon isn't a bad choice for Earth, not because I don't like Iowa or Wisconsin, but because at the Grand Canyon you have these stacks of sediments, and every single one of them has a different story to tell because they were deposited in different conditions. And so looking up that stack, you can kind of watch history unfold as as conditions changed, as the environment changed, as things got worn away and then added to and so on. That's one of the main reasons that Gale Crater was chosen, because you have a stack of sedimentary deposits, what we believe to be sedimentary deposits, in the middle of the crater. And we are hoping that that will be a record of a long swath of the history of Mars. So we believe that that's a good place to go to get the best bang for the resources that we have been privileged to use.
And where were the other Mars rovers roving?
Well, Spirit landed in Gale Crater, and Opportunity landed in the plains of Meridiani. And all of these places are very different. They were chosen partly due to the science, and this is true for Gale as well, partly due to the science that could be done there, and partly because of engineering constraints. Depending on your method of landing, that will determine, you know, how big the rocks can be, for example, on the surface. So you need something pretty flat if you're landing with airbags, for example, because you don't want them to pop. So engineering constraints also come into play.
Thank you, John, for the call. We have Don in West Salem next. Hello, Don.
Yes, good morning to you.
Morning.
Couple questions. When your rover's exploring and such, what would happen if you discover life of even a minor form? What would your direction go if you did discover life? And if you didn't discover life at all, would you attempt to try terraforming to see if you could get anything to grow?
Hmm.
Well, those are pretty far-reaching questions. Let me try and answer them in terms of the rover that we currently have. Curiosity is not necessarily designed to find life. It's designed to explore whether or not a region might have once been habitable. So it's not really designed to be a life detector, for example. If we were somehow to find extant life, which I think is probably not likely, that would radically change how we would continue on with the mission, obviously. And I wouldn't even begin to try and figure out how that would happen. In terms of terraforming, again, we're getting into conjecture as far as I'm concerned, because, again, I'm a scientist, not an engineer. But technically, I don't think there are necessarily any impediments. It's simply a question of, you know, is this a priority that we want to pursue?
Thank you, Don, for the call. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Eileen Yangst. She is the director of the Wisconsin Space Grant Consortium at UW Green Bay, an adjunct assistant professor. She is also in Pasadena, California right now, working with NASA on the Curiosity mission. She is deputy principal investigator for one camera on the mission. And our next caller is Earl in Medford. Hi, Earl.
Hi, good. Great show. I just wanted to speak on behalf of Mars. A listener mentioned just blowing dust, but it's fascinating. It's got the biggest mountains, the highest mountains, and a beautiful canyon, much bigger than the Grand Canyon, and a very good chance of life, I believe. And also, it has not only inspired people recently, but way back, Robert Goddard, the father of American rocketry, was inspired by Mars to go into that field and suffer failure after failure because he wanted to get a rocket that would go to Mars. So it's inspiring. It's the most Earth-like planet that we know of, and it really has attracted people of all kinds of backgrounds and that all around the world with that Mars.
Yeah, well, he has a fascination with Mars like a lot of people, Professor Yangst.
Well, I have to admit, Mars is one of my favorite planets, too. Mm-hmm. And I get the sense that perhaps the caller is a nascent geologist or a budding geologist. What he said is absolutely accurate. Mars is a world of tremendous extremes. Olympus Mons is the largest mountain in the solar system. It's three times the height of where a jet plane would fly. So again, if you're in a plane flying by Olympus Mons, two-thirds of the mountain are still above you. It's got the deepest canyon with Valles Marineris. It is, and yet it has a lot of things that remind us of Earth. Its day is 24 hours and 37 minutes long. It, you know, if you take all of the land area of Earth, not the oceans, but the land, it's approximately the land surface of Mars. It has deserts with moving dunes. It has sandstorms. It has many things that remind us of Earth. So it is exotic. It's familiar, and yet it's very exotic. And I think the images that we'll be releasing today and that we have released and will continue to release will show that it's, you know, a place that, you know, maybe one day my kids will want to go to. But it has become not just a dot in the sky, but an actual place.
Well, what is it that you hope we find on the surface of Mars, or that you hope curiosity, what questions you hope curiosity will answer?
Well, I hope curiosity will help us better understand the climate history, for one thing. Again, Mars was very different early on in the history of the solar system. It was once much more hospitable than it is now. And I would like to understand better what changed and why. And I think that has profound implications for our own Earth and our own climate. So I hope that in those stacks of sediments, we get an idea of the changing environment on the surface and what that might mean for us.
And how long are you going to be in Pasadena working on Curiosity?
We have what are called co-located landed operations, which is just a fancy way of saying we're all in the same place doing the same work. And right now that's scheduled to go for 90 Martian days, 90 sols. So that puts me here until about November, sometime early, mid-November. Now, I have small kids, so
oh.
I will be flying home for long weekends and that sort of thing every once in a while. But really, this is the most efficient way to use, again, this tremendous resource that we've been granted. And I know that, you know, this is not something that... There are a lot of people who are very excited about it. There are a lot of people who are terribly unexcited about it. And I just would want to say thank you to all of the individuals who have contributed to this mission. That's essentially everyone in this country.
Mm-hmm.
We as scientists are very humbled and very grateful for the opportunity to do geology for the ages. On behalf of the American people and on behalf of the world, we are very humbled and grateful for that chance.
Well, I love that you also talk in Martian time. Kathleen in Green Bay. We're almost out of time, Kathleen. What did you want to say?
I just wanted to ask, I'm a cultural historian in Green Bay here. What can the culture do in the United States and around the world to prepare itself what was going to happen in space exploration in the future, whether that means discovering new life, going to the stars with the 100-year starship? How do we prepare ourselves?
Well, I'm not a cultural historian, mm-hmm. but my opinion would be that the best thing we could do is to make sure that our students are as literate in math and science as they are in their native language. That is the currency of exploration, and it's the currency of technological advancement, and it's also in part the currency of democracy. If we're going to understand the things that we are trying to fund, then it's important to be literate in both math and science.
Well, this has just been fascinating. I want to thank you, Eileen Yangst, for being with us, and we'll follow your work through MOLLE, I guess.
Thank you so much, Joy.
Eileen Yangst, Adjunct Assistant Professor, Director of the Wisconsin Space Grant Consortium at UW Green Bay. She is the Deputy Principal Investigator for the MOLLE camera on the Curiosity mission. Thanks to Amanda Magnus for producing this hour. Thanks to Naya Mukherjee for on-air production. Thank you for listening. You can go to the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page to see some of the images being sent back by Curiosity. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.